Hello, I'm Eric Topol. I'm the editor-in-chief of Medscape, and I'm really privileged today to have Ed Young with me, who is the Atlantic Magazine science journalist, actually one of my favorite science journalists in the world. And Ed is going to tell us a bit about not only the work he does, the new book that he just had come out, which has been an immense success, by the way, and what it's like to really cover some of the most interesting parts of biomedical science. So, Ed, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And let's maybe first get back. I knew you went to Cambridge and got your baccalaureate and master's degree in zoology.
So I got an undergraduate degree in zoology with a splash of molecular biology.
And now you went from the National Geographic. You had an interesting blog there. Mm-hmm. And very recently, within, the last year or so, went to the Atlantic. Is that right?
I've been a science writer for just over 10 years now. And I've been at the Atlantic for the last 1.5 of that. I was the first and for some time the only staff science writer they had. The Atlantic is a very long, august publication. It has covered health and technology for a long while, and it recently decided to put a new emphasis on science coverage too, which is where I came in.
Yeah, they have such strength in other areas that I've met some. In fact, the Atlantic has had conferences right in this forum where they have the Atlantic meets the Pacific.
Right.
And they like James Fallows and so many, you know, Corby and many other the journalists there. But it's great that you're gonna that you have already and that you're gonna continue to bolster some of the science coverage. But do you get to write on anything you want?
Yeah, roughly. So I pitch all my story ideas, and the Atlantic, I think, is a wonderful culture where they recruit people who they know are good and then give them largely free rein to be the journalist they want to be with all the editorial and, you know, institutional support that they can provide. So I write about what I want to write, and I cover all sorts of topics from genomics to microbiology to increasingly science policy for obvious reasons, animal behavior, the whole works.
Yeah, and how do you pick an article? There's so many things that come out every week.
Right.
What is the way that you zoom in and say, this is the one?
The first criterion, and really the only one that truly matters, is whether I'm interested in something or not. So whether it makes me excited enough to want to write about it, because I then can then convey that excitement to audiences. I think that I care a lot about stories that I'm trying to move away from just writing about, here is this week's like big new Nature paper or the science paper of the week. I'm interested in stories that show the process of science, to talk about the way people do science, the lives of scientists, increasingly how science is engaging with the realm of politics and policy, to tell the stories of patients. I like to think of journalism as giving voice to the voiceless, and that could be underrepresented groups. It could be things that literally have no voice, like endangered species or ecosystems or microbes. The whole thing works.
Right. Well, I know we first came together when you were giving. I asked you actually if you could talk to a patient of mine,
right,
who was essentially voiceless but had diagnosed herself.
Mm-hmm.
And with a very complicated multiple rare diseases, actually. And so you did it. It wasn't easy, I guess, right?
Yeah, it was hard. And it's always hard when you're telling people stories. You want to make sure it's scientifically rigorous, also very respectful of what people have gone through. But these are the stories that I love telling. I think they are a way of humanizing science, and I think getting away from the idea that science coverage is just a stream of discoveries or breakthroughs or whatever.
It's
so much more than that. It's a process of knowing the world and a very important part of the world around us.
So because of your background, do you have a natural propensity for the microbiome and zoology, that sort of stuff?
I've always been a fan of zoology. I've loved, I was the kid who went to zoos, who watched David Attenborough documentaries. But I think my interests are pretty broad. I didn't study microbiology when I was at university. I like to say that I write about everything that is or was once alive.
Okay.
and And, you know, I started writing about microbiology quite early on when I became a science writer, and it's sort of been this continuing fascination since then. I don't really know why it is. I think it's because microbes are almost like the ultimate underdogs. Right? We can't see them. We tend to fear them. If we don't fear them, we ignore them. But they have incredible stories to tell as well. And it turns out that they are core players in our stories. They rather than things that just kill us or are signs of dirt or, you know, disease, they are crucially important, and they are part of us. And I think this grander view of ourselves as ecosystems, as worlds in our own right, is, I think, a deeply subversive and really fascinating way of understanding ourselves. And that's why I wanted to write the book. I feel my contention is that if we don't understand our relationships with the microbes that we that share our bodies, we don't really properly understand our own biology.
So you did, with this 10 years of journalism, you did at some point, perhaps a couple of years ago, commit to doing a book. Mm-hmm. The topic couldn't be hotter, of course.
It couldn't. And actually, I steered away from it for that reason. I feel like the human microbiome field has a lot of interesting stories within it, but it is also a growing field that is suffering from the problems that any young field has, that human genetics had when in its earlier days of a lot of hype and exaggeration. But I felt that a book that focused solely on that would be too early, too preliminary.
Right.
But there has been so much work on animal microbiomes in general, on the microbiomes of squid and aphids and deep sea worms and mosquitoes and all of this stuff that when I realized that I had actually been covering that as well for a very long time, and that I could tell those stories in tandem and use the stories of animal microbiomes to kind of to inform and draw parallels with the human work. That's when I thought, like, this is a book. It's not going to be a diet book or a health book or, you know, a self-help book.
Right.
It's going to be a natural history book that focuses on the hidden natural history that people don't know about.
No, and it's an extraordinary book, just as you nicely summarized. And when I read it, I thought, well, this is clearly going to be a New York Times bestseller, and that was before it even had come out. And it's really quite exceptional. I knew it was going to be good because I watched your TED Talk.
Okay,
which was a couple of years prior. It was something about roach. What was
parasites
it?
Parasites on mind-controlling parasites.
Yeah. And I said, well, this is going to be, of course, it was ideal to see that transformed to a book with so much more depth and mm-hmm. breadth. What kind of impact do you think it's been for you and for the field?
I went into the book thinking that I really wanted it to be accessible and interesting to the general public, to people who just about know what bacteria are, and not a lot beyond that. You know, they get that there are small things, fine. And I wanted to open their eyes to this new way of seeing the world, of seeing themselves and all the other life that they were familiar with. But I also wanted the book to be useful to the field, because the field is going through such a tumultuous, almost teething period. I think it's a time where it's very useful to have kind of a synthesis of what is happening and how to think about the microbiome, you know, in this deeper ecological way, and not just about as a means of improving our health, but as a more fundamental way of looking at biology. And I feel that from the comments I've had and the reviews I've had, that you know, that those goals have been realized. Like, I've had a lot of positive feedback, interestingly, from both the mainstream and the scientific press. So, you know, it's very gratifying when you get good reviews in the New York Times, but also Science.
Right.
And I think that it's certainly, and this is really the reason why I wrote the book in the first place, it really helped to crystallize my own thoughts on the field. Being able to delve into it for 1.5 years and interview, you know, all the best people in it, and to understand it on a historical level and a conceptual level, was just you couldn't ask for a better opportunity. I feel like it has influenced and helped my own reporting on this since.
Well, you've kind of differentiate yourselves among so many fine journalists as being a particularly great explainer, and you add lots of humor like you did in the book, but it's also in all, it's thread throughout all your pieces. How do you do that? How do you get down to the nuts to make it fun and not just injecting humor, get it down to a level that everybody grabs onto it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't know. It sort of plays to the way I'm built. So I'm naturally quite irreverent. I'm somewhat disrespectful of authority and, like, you know, established power structures. And it helps to when you're trying to explain something in a very simplistic, in not a simplistic, but in a very easy to understand way, in an accessible way, because you know, I think the idea that science should be like a little bit stuffy, very formal. Yeah. It's very against the way I think.
You just undress it all,
right? And you know, and I think that's the type of communication and the type of reading that I like that I engage with. That drove my fascination for the natural world when I was a kid. And I think that, you know, it being able to peel back a lot of the, you know, the formality that surrounds this field, and actually, you know, talk to people in a very natural way, as if you were, you know, in a bar or just chatting, like, across a dinner table. I think that's really important.
Right. Well, that's a great lesson for people that like to write or really communicate. In fact, you even got the award from the National Academy of Sciences for such extraordinary communication. So another congratulatory point there. Now, the microbiome has been a subject in medicine of tremendous hype, and it's been linked with virtually every disease of mankind,
from
autism to, you know, last week it was irritable bowel syndrome. Mm-hmm. And how are we going to pierce through all this overhype?
It's hard. I do think it is a problem, because a lot of the studies that draw links between the human microbiome and all these various diseases and disorders are small. They're correlative studies done in animal models. You know, they don't necessarily say whether the microbes are responsible for the disease or a consequence thereof. We don't know whether the microbes are initiating or exacerbating the condition. You know, we don't know, so irritable bowel syndrome, like a lot of other conditions, has been on the increase recently. Is that to do with changes in the microbiome? You know, the field, I like to say, is very good at finding statistically significant effects, but not so hot at the moment for finding actually significant effects, right? So I think these are the sort of teething problems that go in any young field. Like, human genetics went through exactly the same thing in its early stages. Small correlative studies that found a lot of compelling associations, some of which turned out to be false positives. So we'll get there just as the field progresses. You know, we've gone from a point where microbiology was entirely dominated by study of infectious diseases to now this greater understanding of host-microbe relationships and the importance of benign and beneficial microbes living within us. So I think we'll get there, but I think the field is also becoming increasingly introspective about this problem. You know, I've heard this discussed a lot, and there will still be small weak studies out there, but I think that I get the sense of change and movement in the right direction.
Well, I like your optimism there. And you certainly kind of dissected some of the key problems there. Mm-hmm. Earlier you showed with emojis the way a fecal transplant works.
Right, yeah.
And that's kind of like that's you. I mean, only you could think of emojis
emoji.
Showing.
Right.
And it got a roaring applause of this. How do you come up with this stuff, really?
I mean, you know, I wanted it to be fun, you know. And the thing about fecal transplants is, I have learned this the hard way. You literally cannot talk about them without people wanting to make jokes anyway, right? Because there's such a weird idea. Like, the problem with writing about fecal transplants is you make puns even if you try not to make puns. So I figure you might as well just go all in and go, you know, people have badges saying, like, I gave a shit. I think... To be serious for a bit, the thing about fecal transplants that I think is really interesting is that they have been so powerful for treating C. diff, and they were ignored for a very long time, and they are now gaining traction in the medical establishment. And I think actually they're a really good example of this old axiom that there's no such thing as alternative medicine. If it works, it just becomes medicine.
Right.
And that's actually what's happening here. You know, you have this thing that sounds so medieval and weird, and yet because people have actually tested it in rigorous clinical studies and because with evidence base is built up, it's now the subject of serious investigation, and it's something that doctors are taking very seriously. You know, the FDA is looking at how to regulate fecal transplants. I think it's a really good case study of the power of solid evidence to make a change in how we practice medicine.
Yeah, no, it's actually startling in things like C. difficile, the profound impact it's mm-hmm. had, and how the question is, you know, can it be extended to other conditions, and also can it be simulated without the
right,
without
yeah.
that undesirable aspect of it. Now, you also, I think, have some really good points about probiotics, which have mm-hmm. all sorts of false claims out there, and they're being taken mm-hmm. widely. Are there any data to support use of probiotics?
Yeah, and you know, they seem to be good for things like infectious diarrhea. So, like C. diff is an example. But you know, they've been linked to so much stuff. Fairly nebulous claims like boost digestion, or you know, helps your immunity, to very specific ones about everything from, you know, inflammatory bowel disease to colds and flu, and there the evidence is far, far more mixed and less convincing. I think the general principle of trying to add beneficial bacteria to your body to improve your health is a theoretically sound one, but I think we need to get much more savvy about which taxa we use, how we go about doing that, how we try and... you know, it's not like taking a vitamin supplement. It is much more complicated than that. These are living, evolving organisms. They have, you know, they eat things. They have ecological niches. So I think we need to get more subtle and more informed about how we go about designing probiotic therapies. And we just need a higher caliber of evidence, I think.
One of the things that you need to do, obviously, is tracking this flood of information that comes out on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And I obviously know you also through Twitter. You're very you show up a lot on Twitter. You have a lot of following. How do you use Twitter, and why do you use it?
I use it for lots of different reasons. I use it to promote my own work and to share it with other people. I actually use it as a way of finding stories. So I follow a lot of scientists, and I listen to their conversations, and I find that it's a very good way of getting a lay of the land in fields in a way that's quite similar to going to conferences. So rather than just seeing a field like the microbiome in terms of the papers that are being pushed out, if you look at the debates that are going on Twitter, you get a better sense of where the controversies lie, like what people are excited about, which papers people think are good, which papers people think are bad. So it's a really good way of keeping on top of the areas that I'm interested in. It has been a great way of finding sources, of finding scientists who, you know, like yourself, who share interesting things, who I know I can go to for comments. And it's been a good way of, you know, socializing with the science journalism community, too. It's a very thriving group of people.
I learn a lot every day from it. And last thing I wanted to get to was you moved recently from the UK to DC.
Right, yeah.
Within the past year or so?
Well, actually, formally within the past month.
Oh, that's really recent.
I mean, okay. I heard you guys love immigrants, so I thought I would remember it.
Well, that actually brings me to my last question.
Right.
Because I follow you on Twitter, and I don't get to see you nearly enough, but I kind of can get into your mind, mm-hmm. you're tweeting a fair amount on political turmoil, which, you know, I learned through that, too. Mm-hmm. The question I have is, has all the problems that are happening in this country currently with the administration and immigration, and you know, every day it's something else. Mm-hmm. Does that distract you from what you want to do, what you like to do?
It actually gives me a new focus, like one of several. I'm not going to stop writing about basic science, genetics, and microbiology, but I do think that I've done a lot more science policy stories recently, and I think this is a time when journalism is, you know, more important than ever. It is a vital component in preserving democracy, in shining a light on things that on stories that aren't being told, on holding the powerful accountable. And I think as the new administration rolls in, journalism will continue to be incredibly important. So I've written stories about threats to the nature of expertise itself, regulatory changes that will make it harder for scientific evidence to be effectively used in policy. I've written speculative pieces about how the new administration will be able to cope with, say, a pandemic like the Ebola outbreak. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. How will that play out, given what we've seen and given the track record of the people currently in power? I think that's an important thing for people to understand. Right. When the immigration ban happened, which, by the way, happened like literally hours after my flight landed in Dulles, science and politics are not disparate things. Science is done by scientists, and scientists have political opinions and are profoundly impacted by political decisions. So after that happened, I wrote a piece detailing how the immigration ban affects scientists, how it affects people from those seven targeted countries, how a lot of America's great science comes from people from, say, Iranian backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And I've written stories about how scientists are engaging with policy, how many of them, like Michael Eisen, who's talking at this conference, are considering running for office. I've interviewed scientists who have successfully run for office in places like Canada. I think it's not... I don't see this as a distraction. Right. I think it's arguably some of the most important work that I do now, and it's a privilege and an honor to be able to do that kind of reporting at somewhere like The Atlantic, which prizes it. You know, it values it so much. There's a real fire and energy in the newsroom at the moment. The Atlantic was founded a long time ago, kind of as an organ of emancipation. Mm. You know, we were championing civil rights from the very start, and I think being part of that institution and being able to give voice to how science is being affected in the current administration feels like a tremendous honor at the moment.
Yeah, actually, I hadn't even thought of the connecting the dots with the long heritage mm-hmm. legacy that Atlantic has brought us in terms of covering this stuff. Mm-hmm. Are you going to be working on another book?
So not for now. I have no particular ideas. Although I will say that that on this particular question, I have a track record of being full of shit because I specifically said that I wasn't going to do a book to the man who is now my agent.
I see.
Literally weeks before I then sent him my book proposal.
Uh-huh,
so,
okay.
So I'm telling you now that I did not have a second book idea, and it is true, but it may also be not true in days or weeks. Who can say?
Yeah, well, knowing you at the young age of 35, you got all kinds of stuff ahead of you, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's multiple books. I really want to thank you for being such an extraordinary journalist and teaching us all the time the stuff that you cover. And not only that, but you get onto the hot topics, but you do it in a way that just makes it eminently readable and enjoyable. So thanks for all your hard effort. It doesn't come easy. And thanks for all of you for tuning into this conversation with Ed Young and I, and for all your support of Medscape.